session number 4799, runner number 2.
Air Vice Marshal Long, Reel 2. And Air Marshal, you were just telling us about operations against the Kurds.
The squadron was equipped with de Havilland 9As, always called for short 9X. They were first introduced into the service right at the towards the end of the First War. They had an American Liberty engine, which was, for those days, good and comparatively reliable. Conditions in 55 Squadron, we lived, of course it had been before the war, it had been part of Turkey, and it was called the Mosul Vilayet, V-I-L-A-Y-E-T. And we lived, our mess was an old Turkish fort on the edge of the aerodrome at Mosul, and the airmen were accommodated in huts and tents. There were large numbers of British troops in those days in, I'm going to call it Iraq for short, there were large numbers of British troops and Indian troops in the country in those days, of which we had the mandate. For example, at Mosul, we had a battalion of the 9th Rajputs. There were also the Iraq levies, the Iraq army and the Assyrian levies. And these troops were used as necessary to cooperate with the RAF to control the country. The climate, of course, was extremely hot in the summer, with temperatures in the 120s, and tropical radiators had to be fitted to the aircraft, which held an extra 5 gallons of water. Otherwise, the engines would have overheated. So you had these tropical radiators with the extra weight for about 6 months of the year. The spring, autumn, and winter climate was pleasant, and the radiators were removed, and the aircraft put back to standard. We did demonstration flights in covering large areas of the north of the country. A lot of which, of course, is extremely mountainous, and there were small landing grounds developed amongst the in the valleys in the mountainous region of Kurdistan, and from these we were able to operate as required. The AOC and C in those days was Air Marshal, or Air Vice Marshal as he was then, Sir John Salmond, and the running of the country, it was eventually agreed, should be handed over to the RAF with, of course, the cooperation of the army as necessary. This became more or less routine until in 1924 there was this definite threat from Turkey, and Turkish troops were infiltrating into the northern part of the country, and we were, to all intents and purposes, more or less at undeclared war with Turkey. And columns of troops were sent to defend the country, and we, the RAF and my squadron in particular, cooperated with them, dropped supplies on them, picked up messages and dropped messages on them. It was an interesting operation, and occasionally one got shot at, but nobody was shot down. Although I, for one, did happen to get a bullet through the undercarriage of my aircraft, which very luckily missed the tropical radiator. Otherwise, I should have had to land. The nearest squadron to us, which joined in these operations, was number 30 squadron, which was then based at Kirkuk. This squadron was commanded by squadron leader Collishaw, Raymond Collishaw, who had done marvelous work in the First War and had many decorations. After he left the squadron, it was commanded by squadron leader Robb, who became Air Marshal Sir James Robb in due course. When there was trouble up in the north with the Turks like this, then squadrons used to come up from Baghdad and were based either at Kirkuk or at Mosul. We, for example, had number 1 squadron on top of Stripes up at Mosul at one time, and similarly squadrons came up and were based at Kirkuk, so that the full power of the Royal Air Force in the country could be used to deal with the Kurds and the infiltration of and the infiltration of Turkish troops.
When it came to dealing with the troublesome tribesmen like the Kurds, did you actually attack them with guns or bombs, or was it just a demonstration of?
Yes, we did. We had bombs, and we had to go and drop these bombs on various targets. One of the main ones of which was a place called Roundouz, Rowanduz, which was at the end of a valley, and there was a famous gorge called the Roundouz Gorge, which I think from memory was between 1,700 and 2,000 feet deep, through which of course a river flowed, and it was one of our main targets. The nigger in the woodpile in those days was Sheikh Mahmoud, and we were always chasing him and trying to destroy him, but he always eluded us and eventually escaped into Persia. He was known by the nickname of the director of training, and unfortunately I never clapped eyes on him, but I did try and do him a lot of no good by dropping bombs on places where he was reported to be taking refuge. the rest of the work concerned was doing demonstrations and evacuating casualties, if any. Incidentally, I think it is of interest that there was an evacuation of friendly people from a large village. It was almost a small town called Sulaimania, which is up on the near the Persian frontier in northern Iraq. And I think I'm right in saying that this was the first time that people had ever been evacuated by air. It was before the much better known evacuation of Kabul.
What aircraft?
We had Vickers Vernons from Hinaide, and we also used our own DH-9As to bring passengers out. Incidentally, I heard on the radio or saw in the paper only the other day that this most attractive, at least it was in my day, village of Sulaimania has just recently been bombed by the Iranians. Also, of course, Kirkuk, which one knew so well, has also been bombed because it is one of the greatest oil-producing parts of the country. It was during my time in Iraq that the airmail between Baghdad and Cairo was opened up, and that the landing grounds across the desert were fully developed, and that it was possible to to fly from Baghdad to Cairo. Incidentally, I did go home on a short leave at one time, and I flew from Baghdad to Cairo, and from then on by ship and train, and I arrived in England 8.5 days after leaving Baghdad. Everybody I met in England thought this was absolutely staggering, whereas today, of course, you can do it in about 8 hours. I was then posted from, after my 3 years in Iraq, I was posted to number 47 Squadron at Helwan, which is about 15 miles outside Cairo, and this squadron was also equipped with de Havilland 9As. The commanding officer was Squadron Leader Malcolm Henderson. The squadron's role was to do demonstrations, and to there was also a transport squadron, number 216 squadron, which was based just outside Cairo. The most interesting thing that happened to me during my year in there were two interesting things that happened to me during my year with 47 Squadron. The first was that after I had been in the squadron only a fortnight, and one evening I was having a drink in the hotel in Helwan, when my commanding officer came up to me and said, "Long, I want you to fly to Khartoum tomorrow morning." Well, I was young, and my knowledge of geography was not terribly good. I had, of course, had heard of Khartoum, but I didn't quite realize how it lay in relation to Helwan and how far it was, etc. However, I went straight back to the squadron and arranged that my aircraft should be ready to take off very early the following morning, accompanied by one other aircraft. I asked my CO why I was going to fly to Khartoum and who my passenger was going to be. He said, "I cannot tell you." So I arrived at crack of dawn the next morning to take off for Khartoum. My passenger turned out to be an Egyptian officer, and the reason that the flight to Khartoum was necessary was that there had been a mutiny of the Egyptian army in Khartoum, and this officer, the senior officer, was to be flown down there in order to try and quell or prevent the mutiny spreading. The trip to Khartoum following the Nile was uneventful, but unfortunately we were held up at Atbara on the Nile with slight engine trouble, and so did not arrive in Khartoum quite as quickly as we might have done. And we found that the mutiny was in full swing, and that there was nothing that this senior officer that I had flown there could do. The mutiny was eventually suppressed, and the leaders of the mutineers were executed. We had a detached flight at Khartoum, and I was kept down there for about a month or 6 weeks, just in case more trouble flared up, so that the detached flight was augmented by myself and the pilot who had come in the other aircraft. Unfortunately, we were not able to see much of the Sudan because we did not want to waste flying hours in case there was trouble, and therefore one was more or less confined to just the local area around Khartoum itself. I do remember that on Christmas Day the temperature in Khartoum was 91, so it was a fairly warm place to serve in. I eventually returned from Khartoum to Helwan, and where I was met by my wife, who had been able to join me in the country. But when she arrived, of course, I was in Khartoum, and so she didn't see me until I was able to get back from there. The remainder of my time with 47 Squadron was taken up with routine flying. For example, we flew Susefton Branca on a tour in Palestine and all around the area. Also at that time, but unfortunately I did not take part in it, was a flight from Cairo to Kano, which was led by Mary Cunningham, who at that time was attached to RAF headquarters in Cairo.
Sefton Branca being Minister for Air in those days, was he?
He was, yes, he was Director of Civil Aviation.
Ah.
Yes. Well, and also the other interesting thing that happened to me whilst I was in the in 47 Squadron was that my short service commission was due to run out in September of that year, which was 1925, and so I was beginning to think that I should have to go back to civil life. But one evening I was informed that an Air Ministry order had been published in which my name appeared as having been granted a permanent commission. This delighted me, of course, and I knew then that I could make the service my career. My 4 years was up at the end of 1925, and I was posted home on leave, awaiting my next appointment. It was whilst I was on that leave that my appointment came through, and I was told that I had to report for duty as a test pilot at Farnborough in January 1926.
Before we go on to your time at Farnborough, when your wife arrived in Egypt, was this because there was some relenting by the Air Ministry about wives, or was it just a private venture?
Well, no, you could always have your wife in Egypt, but you could not have your wife in Iraq. Everybody, all the married people had their wives in Egypt, and so the social life in Egypt was considerable. We got on very well with the local people, and of course Cairo was a center of fun and gaiety, and the famous Gezira Club just outside Cairo, where every sport of various kinds could be indulged in.
Were there any contact with the Egyptians in those days, socially?
Yes, one had slight contact. There was an Egyptian whose name I remember, and his name was Said Taha, and he was an Egyptian policeman. And he could not have been more helpful or nicer, and we got on with him and any of the other local Egyptian that we met extremely well. Of course, it was during my time there, and this, I think, rather perhaps sparked off the mutiny in Khartoum, that the Sardar, which meant the commander-in-chief, was murdered.
And then you went back to Farnborough?
Yes, I did. I was posted to Farnborough in January of 1926. Farnborough, of course, is a famous word in the history of British aviation. It was originally, before the First World War, it was originally the balloon factory. And when I went there, the balloon shed was still there, and as far as I know, it's still there today. It then became the Royal Aircraft Factory and was responsible for designing and producing during the First War such famous aircraft as the B-2C, the RE-8 and the SE-5. The Farnborough was a civilian establishment, and the only Royal Air Force personnel were the pilots who flew the aircraft, and it was known as the Experimental Section, RAE. There were three flights: an aerodynamics flight, a wireless flight, and an engine research flight. And it was to the last of these that I was assigned, the engine research flight. As the name implies, our main work was the research and development of British aero engines. In particular, from the point of view of supercharged engines and high-altitude flying. The aircraft we had were service types, DH-9A, the Bristol Fighter, and various other experimental types that were given to us later. The engines we were using in those days were mostly the Napier Lion, and these engines were fitted experimentally with what we called in those days were exhaust-driven superchargers. And today, as we know, they are now called turbochargers, and in a very small scale are used in certain motor cars. But in those days, it was a new diversion, and a lot of our work was taken up with this. The effect of putting an exhaust-driven supercharger onto an engine like the Napier Lion was quite extraordinary. And we did a lot of high-altitude flying using these engines not only in the DH-9A, but in certain single-seater, experimental single-seater fighters as well. It absolutely transformed the performance of the DH-9A, and in fact, I succeeded in doing a ceiling climb once on a DH-9A with the supercharged engine to 32,000 feet. The temperature, air temperature outside was minus 61 degrees centigrade, and in an open cockpit, one had to be wrapped up fairly well to try and keep warm. The heated clothing we wore was a complete suit with wiring inside it, rather like a modern electric blanket today, and the power supply was off a generator propelled by a small propeller mounted on one of the center section struts. It was not reliable, but when it did work 100%, it was quite satisfactory, but one could never be sure that it was going to be working properly. The supply of oxygen, of course, was also absolutely essential, and oxygen masks were designed by the people at the RAE. Oxygen supply at anything above 25,000 feet was duplicated, in that we had high-pressure oxygen cylinders, and we also had thermos flasks filled with liquid oxygen, the temperature of which, incidentally, is minus 183 degrees centigrade. And this, if you one of the two sources failed, you could switch over to the other. We never had a double failure, and the oxygen supply had always proved satisfactory, which was just as well, because, of course, if you have a complete oxygen failure at 30,000 feet or above, you are unconscious in a matter of seconds. There was a great deal of other work as well, fuel consumption, different types of carburetors, and development of the what became the Kestrel engine of Rolls-Royce, which powered the Hart and the Demon and the Fury later on. And also we were doing a lot of work into the supercharging of radial engines produced by Bristol's and Armstrong Whitworth.
Was your flying work directed very much by the scientists?
Yes, that is so. We had a number of civilians in the, for example, in the engine flight, the head man of which was a man called Penn, and the work that they wanted us to do, and the type of flying, and the information to be gained and written down on our pads, on our knee, was laid down by them, and we each one of us filled in a printed form after the flight was completed, giving the various readings, the revs, the temperatures, the back pressure, etc., etc., etc. And this was, we signed these forms, and they went to the appropriate people. Incidentally, my commanding officer in those days at Farnborough was Squadron Leader B.E. Baker, who became Air Marshal Sir Brian Baker, and it was only recently that he died. It may be of interest just to say that one of our civilian observers was a young man by the name of McCudden, and he was the younger brother of the famous McCudden fighter pilot of the First War, who got the VC. He was an outstanding observer, and I think would have made an extremely good pilot himself if he had the opportunity to learn to fly. I took every opportunity whilst I was at Flounder to fly every different type of aeroplane that was available in the other flights as well.